Our third case for this morning is Tully against Barada. And whenever you're ready, Mr. Sutherland.
There you are. If it pleases the court, counsel, my name is Michael Sutherland and I represent Mr. Michael Tully. We have two issues before the court. In substance, we believe that the Constitution does provide for a cause of action of malicious prosecution either under the Fourth Amendment or under the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment issue I will address first. We believe it is supported in the Albright case, and we believe that it is also supported in the Belinsky case, which came out of this circuit. The analysis in the Belinsky case does primarily focus on the Fourth Amendment, but does acknowledge that there is a Fourth Amendment cause of action under the theory of malicious prosecution in sister states, such as the Second, Third, and Fifth districts, or circuits, rather.
Now, but how do you get around the fact that the state court here had to have found probable cause to go forward, which under any law of malicious prosecution I know is fatal to that kind of claim?
This is a review de novo, Your Honor, and we believe that we've alleged that the probable cause was not established.
It's not that simple, because we have a state court finding of probable cause. Now, point one, the fact that eventually it's found that there's insufficient evidence to support a conviction doesn't undermine a finding that there was probable cause to start it. Those are two different standards. Point two, there are all manner of federalism-related doctrines that preclude federal courts from effectively overturning findings by state courts. There are obligations relating to issue preclusion. There are obligations under the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. We're not free to just say, well, you know, the state court shouldn't have found probable cause, so we'll just revisit that.
Well, we're not exactly revisiting it because there's been no evidentiary review. This is simply on the pleadings, and what we have pled is...
But no. I mean, there, you don't disagree that there is a state court finding. That's a matter of judicial record of probable cause.
I think that the case of Malley versus Briggs suggests that you can look at that closely to see whether or not the allegations which support the state's finding of probable cause were in fact truthful or supported.
You're begging it. You're doing this backwards. You cannot look. That's just what Judge Wood told you. We can't. When a judge makes a finding of probable cause, that precludes us from sticking our nose into it.
Only if the facts presented to the judge are honest.
You'd have to review the bidding. We can't take the appeal from what that judge did. And there's no constitutional right, by the way, not to be prosecuted wrongly.
That's the issue that we're raising, is we believe that there is.
But this isn't a case, though. I mean, you said you could that you can't. In response to Judge Bauer's question, you said you can't go back and look at probable cause if the facts were presented properly. But this isn't a case in which anything was hid or fabricated evidence or undisclosed evidence or anything like that, right? I mean, it's just a question of whether the trial judge in the original court properly found your client guilty or not.
No, it's the initiation of the criminal prosecution with the velvet glove of the summons here.
But what was hidden? In other words, what was unfairly presented to the court that made the finding of probable cause?
The prosecutor presented the statement under oath, so he was actually the complaining witness. So he steps outside of his role primarily.
About 60% of all prosecutions are begun by the prosecutor signing the affidavit, not grand jury proceedings besides the affidavit.
Usually,
he does it on the basis of information that's relayed to him by police officers and other investigators.
I know that the prosecutors initiate things, but they usually don't do it under oath.
They do under oath. Now, you're talking to a guy who spent a lot of time at that business.
All right, well, I'm not challenging that. I'm just challenging what my experience
everything
is.
Everything you file with the court is, for practical purposes, under oath.
Well, but this specifically says that he is the complaining witness, just like a police officer coming forward and saying X, Y, and Z. And if you can demonstrate that that's not true,
the judge who looked at this affidavit or whatever it was would have thought that actually the prosecutor was out there on the bridge watching the guys shoot the raccoons? No judge thought that. The judge obviously knew that the prosecutor was communicating something that somebody else had told him.
Well, doesn't the prosecutor or any witness have a duty to at least verify that what he is reporting to the court is true?
He has a duty to decide whether or not his personal and humble opinion is sufficient evidence to hold him. And he files the process and says, I want a warrant. And that's what happens.
The prosecutor has a duty to be fair and honest and complete.
Sure does.
And, sorry?
But there's different ways of handling it. And one of them is not to say that go back and review everything he does. If we take your position carefully, any process that begins with an information filed by the prosecutor would be subject to review by this court. And that can't be the law.
Judge Breyer, the only thing I can tell you is that when I have brought actions because of a police officer lying to a judge about the facts, that is a false arrest, and he's not immune because he has lied to the judge about facts presented.
You sued the police officer.
This is a prosecutor who is also acting
as a police officer.
No. He's not acting as a police officer.
When he puts things under oath, he doesn't...
The statute requires that if he's going to proceed by information, he sign the...
It would be our position that when he signs us under oath, he is the complaining witness and doesn't behave. There's nothing in our statute, Judge, in Indiana, which authorizes a prosecutor to complete the information under oath. He can approve it. He can review it. He can sign off on it.
It has the practical effect of being under oath.
He's the complaining witness, just like anybody else.
Okay, so let's go back to Judge Wood's initial question. So here's what you've got. You've got a report of a gunshot. You've got the sheriff finding your client and the other fellow in the area. They had the gun. They had a dead raccoon. And the sheriff asks him, do you know it's illegal to shoot from the road? And he says, yes. Now, putting aside whether that's sufficient to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, how is that not probable cause? Even if your guy says, I didn't really understand what he was asking me later after the fact, why is that not probable cause?
Because if you look at the Court of Appeals decision and you looked at how they...
Court of Appeals decided that there wasn't sufficient evidence to convict.
I know that, but it was the same evidence that was before the court. Now, there wasn't a scintilla of
evidence. Different standards.
That would mean every time somebody's acquitted, there wasn't probable cause.
But the information that was presented was simply a recitation of the statute. It wasn't even a recitation of the facts that you're talking about. So the judge had no facts. The judge had no information. The prosecutor just put the recitation of the statute and says somebody shooting across the road or somebody shooting from the car, all the alternatives, and then that was the probable cause that he filed. And that is simply not supported by any of the evidence. So what you're suggesting is that anybody could make this up, and if it in fact satisfies the statute, then the prosecutor is the complaining witness, or a police officer is the complaining witness, and the judge approves it, you have probable cause.
Actually, I'm saying something different. I'm looking at your complaint that you filed in the trial court in this case, which has all of the facts that I just said in it. Why couldn't a judge, and I recognize this may not have been what Judge McKinney did, but why couldn't a judge look at that and say, probable cause, you lose?
Are you talking about Judge McKinney?
I'm talking about Judge McKinney in dismissing the case that you've appealed here to this court.
Well, I don't think that's what he was saying. I think what he did say.
I understand that, but I'm asking you. I mean, you've made a lot of arguments about whether, you know, how big of a window there is under Albright versus Oliver and all that. I want to sort of go back to a more threshold level. How is there not probable cause to prosecute your client here?
Because
based on what you allege in your complaint in the federal case.
What we allege is that there was no basis for those facts to be stated.
The problem with your argument, let me suggest another problem.
Okay.
Because you're saying, well, what if people are off there, you know, just reciting the statute, doing things? And it's really an infinite regression of hearings. You know, you want a hearing before there's a probable cause, but then maybe you need a hearing before there's a hearing for the probable cause, and a hearing before that, and a hearing before that. Due process is, in fact, the opportunity to show that there's insufficient evidence. The probable cause gets things going, and then you have all of your rights in a criminal trial or a juvenile trial, whatever kind of trial. And no one's complaining about what Indiana offers for juveniles.
But if the initial initiation of the criminal proceeding is based upon false, arbitrary, or malicious information, then the only remedy that the plaintiff, or in this case the criminal juvenile defendant, would have would be to pursue this as a malicious prosecution claim if there was a state remedy, but since there's not, it's a 1983 claim.
Okay, if you want to save even a little bit of rebuttal time, I think this would be a good...
I would like to. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. I represent the prosecutor, and I'll take the first 5 minutes of the appellee's time. I want to argue that for purposes of the federal malicious prosecution claim, Tully has not shown the violation of a federal right. But to pick up on this Court's discussion, the complaint does not show even a prosecution without probable cause, and it does not show malice. Those are certainly two elements of a state court malicious prosecution action. And so just on that basis alone, Judge McKinney could have dismissed the complaint. But Judge McKinney properly, in deciding to dismiss this case, looked at what a person has to show to establish to stay in federal court on a malicious prosecution claim. You have to do more than say, I was prosecuted without probable cause. That's what this complaint is all about. That's all the allegations add up to. The words Fourth Amendment, 14th Amendment are like in the opening and closing paragraphs of the complaint. You're left with only the allegations about probable cause. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Iqbal case says you have to do more than just apply mere labels to state a claim in your complaint. Only in the briefing in the trial court did Tully attempt to say, well, I was seized for purposes of the Fourth Amendment by the issuance of these summonses in order to appear. Well, this court has foreclosed that kind of claim in the Bielanski case, which is similar to this case, except the facts of Bielanski are even a little harsher. Where a girl was charged in juvenile court and summoned to appear, and she had significant pretrial restrictions on her liberty. Here, all he complains about is, well, he was summoned to appear.
Well, right, we didn't discuss that too much. There's the summons part of this case, and then there's the, if you will, the malicious prosecution part. And I guess my only sense is that given what I'll call the complexities of Albright, since the Supreme Court did not have a unified position, I'm happy to plunge in with the best of them when you need to do it, but if there's a case where there is a threshold problem like probable cause that would fail anybody's test, isn't that a more straightforward way to think about it?
Yes, and this court, I believe, can affirm dismissal on any basis found in the record, and the record certainly shows that the complaint, it doesn't add up, that there was no probable cause. There's no allegation of fraud, of withheld evidence. There is a judicial finding of probable cause, and the only way you can get beyond that is if you can't just say there was a negligent or a failure to investigate. You have to show actual wrongdoing.
And there's also a problem with digging into, well, did the first judge find it in ways that seemed unequivocal? Because once you open the door to assessing the evidence before the first judge, you might as well say that there's de novo review, it seems to me.
Right, and of course there's not. Federal courts don't review the juvenile court's finding of probable cause. You don't even start to review that.
What Judge Wood just said.
So, unless the court has any more questions, thank you.
I don't think so. Thank you. Mr. Horn. The juvenile.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm here for Catherine Kester, the probation officer in this case.
She's the juvenile probation officer?
Correct. In this case, Tully has filed, as we know, a complaint that alleges only that he was prosecuted without probable cause.
So she's the person who actually went and talked to this neighbor who called the police?
I don't think she spoke with the neighbor. I think she, as part of her investigation, she interviewed the DNR gentleman who cited the statute to her that not only included shooting from a roadway but also hunting from a roadway. She did call the parents in and the juvenile and met with them. Then on the basis of that interview, because Tully wasn't coming clean and that there were some issues to iron out, she did recommend that a petition for delinquency be filed on that basis.
This is after the finding of probable cause.
This is prior to that.
That's prior to the finding of probable cause.
The predicate for why she...
Yeah.
Yes.
Or the juvenile court.
This is why the summons gets issued, in other words.
Yes. And then the court makes an initial determination of probable cause, and then we have the trial, which she was represented in, and there were witnesses called and all that, and the court made a true finding, which is the equivalent of a conviction in the juvenile case.
Which eventually gets overturned by...
Right. And that is basically the only evidence that Mr. Tolley is offering in proof of his claim that he was prosecuted without probable cause. That's a scary standard. If we adopted that standard, then who knows what would happen. I think there would be a good deal of civil...
Well, I wouldn't break into a cold sweat as to whether we're going to do something like that.
Excuse me?
I said I wouldn't break into a cold sweat if I were you about us doing that.
Okay, because I had about five things for you guys to worry about if you disagreed with me, so I won't get into those. But there are obvious social policy issues involved with adopting that standard. Another reason to...
Speaking of social policy, I'll just say on the other side, I think your opponent is concerned about prosecutions that are initiated for bad faith and malicious reasons, because it certainly is difficult for someone to have to go through even the process of defending themselves. There are reputational issues. For all I know, this young man, you know, had problems in school. So I think his policy argument on the other side has to do with that, the burdens of being accused.
Right, and the procedural due process clause basically addresses whether this person gets a fair trial or not. That's the reason we have Brady claims. There's no allegation in the complaint that this gentleman did not receive a fair trial, and that's obviously our concern. A fair trial does not mean you were prosecuted without probable cause or you weren't prosecuted without probable cause. Those are two completely different realms. So what Mr. Tolley is asking the court to do is basically create out of whole cloth a malicious prosecution claim that has not yet been recognized in this circuit under federal law. Obviously, this is not the case to do that because we really don't even have a due process interest involved. There's no property involved. His hobby kit wasn't stolen from prison. His car wasn't towed or anything like that. There's no life interest involved and no liberty interest involved, particularly so in this case because we have a juvenile.
I don't know that we need to get there here, but you've got, I mean, if the predominant view is that Justice Kennedy and Justice Thomas's opinion in the Albright case is the governing opinion, basically what they say is that if there wasn't a state malicious prosecution remedy, then all of the stuff you're talking about might be something that would get you into federal court, and then that gets us into Mr. Sutherland's other argument that there's a state statute in Indiana that essentially bars a state malicious prosecution claim. So I'm not sure that you really want to go down that road.
And again, on the state law remedy, I think if this court can assess whether or not there's immunity under the state law, even though it wasn't alleged or asserted in this claim, I think it can also assess whether there was even a state claim in the first place. If you look at the complaint and you compare it to the elements of a state law claim, they don't make it. Mm-hmm. There's probable cause determination by the judge. You can't infer malice from that, and the only way you can rebut that determination is to basically show a Brady-type claim that somebody was lying, that by the time of the trial, after the trial, the defendant discovered that in fact, he'd been lied to, that Catherine Custer made up information, made a misrepresentation to the court, something along that lines. There's none of that in this complaint. This complaint is what Newsom talked about when it says you can't just say you're prosecuted without probable cause and then slap malicious prosecution on top of it. The Constitution doesn't recognize that right. You have to cite a specific constitutional provision. Whether they were tampering with witnesses or whether opposing counsel called the other attorney and told him not to show for the hearing, something specific that you can relate to a specific constitutional provision.
Newsom says those things, but I think going back to Albright, if it's really clear in the face of the Indiana statute that one simply cannot ever, almost in the stump against Sparkman sense, sue the prosecutor, then this may be the case where there's no remedy. Now, if we back up, though, to the probable cause point, that's unimportant because you wouldn't be able to sue somebody who's a non-prosecutor either. But anyway, I think we have the gist of your position. So thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Sutherland?
Well, I'm going up philosophically, but I'd like to try.
Our guest.
In response to the question I think raised about the verified petition for delinquency, which essentially becomes the probable cause presentation to the court, there isn't anything that he has firsthand knowledge of. There isn't anything that was true. And so for him to say, or for any court to say, that all a police officer has to do is come in there and say, well, I think this is the case, and I think these facts are going to bear out, and that becomes the basis for probable cause, would give license to every police officer to simply be literary creative. And that's what we don't want to encourage. So if there is no basis whatsoever for this prosecutor or a police officer or a probation officer to make these allegations, then it seems to me that the next step has to be that the court has to say, all right, Mr. Sutherland, you've put us on notice in your complaint that these things did not happen, and there's no basis for this prosecutor to have drawn the conclusions that any of these things have happened.
But the worst you can say, I think, about that probable cause determination is that it was based on too much speculation. They knew certain things, and they were maybe taking jumps that were a little too big. But for some reason or another, and I certainly don't know why, that didn't seem to bother the state court judge, who was prepared to say this case can go forward. And the case did go forward, and of course there's originally even a conviction. And the Indiana appellate court eventually decides that's based on too little. But I just don't know where you draw the line between cases where there's just too much speculation in the underlying facts and cases where it's a solid enough showing that we shouldn't do anything without, in fact, as Judge Bauer was suggesting, having us review every single case.
Well, I don't think this court needs to review every single case, but I do think that...
Well, the district courts would.
Well, but we did all the discovery. It was just never presented because the court ruled on the motion to dismiss beforehand. I mean, just another 2 months and they would have been able to sort of look at this in a summary judgment fashion. And that would have allowed the court to see whether or not this person was telling the truth. How am I ever going to challenge that?
But I can't. You're admitting then that there would be litigation in some additional court about every single probable cause finding.
All I know is that I've done probably 30 or 40 in which a police officer has unequivocally lied under oath. We've gone into court. We've demonstrated he's lied, even though he's got a warrant, and we recover.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's a kind of a different sort of case.
Well, how do you get there unless you sort of challenge what is happening in the probable cause?
It comes up, as a defense in some cases.
Well, in the criminal case, it could come up. But a lot of times it doesn't come up. It just washes through, and you come back after there's been a favorable disposition. If there, in fact, was a conviction, as there was in this case, then you have to postpone that inevitable challenge until there's a court of appeals review. I've done that many times as well. Fortunately, in this case, the statute of limitations had not run, so we were able to pursue this, and we filed our tort claim notice, which is a requirement of 180 days for a state action and 270, or I'm sorry, for a local action and 270. My time has run out, and I'm not sure I've convinced anybody, but if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
We appreciate your help to your client, and we will take the case under advisement. Thank you very much.